So why are we learning about QFT? There are many reasons. I'd just like to begin by giving a few of them. So one reason that we study QFT is that quantum mechanics plus special relativity imply that particle number is not conserved. So we need some sort of theory that can describe the creation and annihilation of particles, like quantum field theory. So to see why quantum mechanics and special relativity imply that particle number is not conserved, imagine putting a particle, such as an electron, in a box of size L. So there is, by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, some uncertainty in the momentum of the particle. That's at least h bar over L. This, in turn, implies that there is some uncertainty in the energy, which has to be at least h bar c over L. Now, if we make the box smaller and smaller, there's a greater and greater uncertainty in the energy. And if we make the box small enough so that delta E is greater than or equal to 2mc squared, where m is the mass of the particle we're trying to put in the box, we can no longer say for sure that there's only one particle in the box, because we could pop a particle-antiparticle pair out of the vacuum. Second reason to study QFT is the existence of identical particles. So you've all studied quantum mechanics and dealt with multi-particle systems. If you are interested in studying a system of, say, electrons, you want to impose anti-commutation relations. But that's just an additional assumption you put in to the problem at hand. Or if you wanted to study bosons, you'd have to impose that the bosons all commuted. That's just an additional assumption. And you could ask the question, why are all these particles exactly the same? They really need to be exactly the same in order to justify an assumption that we impose either commutation or anti-commutation relations. Why is a electron here in this room now the same as an electron that will be produced 10 billion years from now, 10 billion light years away? There's no answer to that in standard quantum mechanics. Quantum field theory provides an answer, and that is that all electrons in quantum field theory are excitations of a field, the electron field. And so this provides us a deeper answer to this question. The third reason I'd like to give you to motivate study of quantum field theory is locality. So in classical electrodynamics, if we're interested in studying the force between two charged particles, say two electrons or an electron and a proton, we introduce the electromagnetic field, which mediates the force between them. If we have a charged particle, that creates some potential, and the other particle feels the potential. If we move the particle, that will change the field configuration and in a causal way that will affect the other particle. So that's one way we can motivate introducing the electromagnetic field in classical mechanics. The same sort of argument works and follows over to quantum field theory. So if we want to have a causal theory that incorporates quantum mechanics and special relativity, we need to introduce a field. Okay. So that's just a few of many reasons to study quantum field theory. Before I start today, though, I'd just like to give you a brief outline of where we'll be going over the next 3 weeks. So, I will be lecturing for the first half of this course, and I'll focus entirely on spin zero particles and fields that are Lorentz invariant. In the second half of this course, Tibra will tell you about the other cases, spin half particles, fermions, and gauge bosons, spin one case. And he can give you a more detailed outline of what he's going to do next week. My plan for the first 7 lectures, we're studying the spin zero case, is today I'll go over some of the important concepts and facts from classical field theory, just to remind you of some results that you've probably seen before that will be useful when we quantize the field starting tomorrow. And the approach we'll use is the canonical quantization. That will be the subject of tomorrow's lecture. There are two main approaches to QFT, the canonical approach that we'll be discussing in this course, and the path integral approach that will be the subject, one of the subjects of QFT 2. From there, I'll discuss the LSE reduction formula. And over the for the last half of this week, we'll really be interested in trying to understand interacting fields and compute scattering amplitudes. So the LSZ reduction formula is one of the key results that allows us to relate scattering amplitudes to expectation values of time-ordered products of fields. And I'll explain that more on Wednesday. And from there, we'll spend the rest of the week filling in the details, learning how to calculate scattering amplitudes. In particular, we'll discuss the interaction picture and Wick's theorem. And then Feynman diagrams. And scattering amplitudes on Friday. And beginning of next week, on Tuesday, we'll learn how to relate these scattering amplitudes to physically measurable quantities, such as cross sections and decay rates. And finally, next Wednesday, I'll give a brief introduction to loops. You'll see much more about this in QFT2. Any questions? Where are we going? Yes?
When you say first half of the course, you're talking about the first half of
Yes. That's right. So this is the plan for the next 7 lectures. Then Tibor will tell you about spin half and spin one for the second 7 lectures in QFT1. And there's also another course that starts next month. Okay. Okay, so today we'll discuss classical field theory. Okay. And as I stated earlier, we'll be interested in scalar fields only for the first half of this course, for the next 7 lectures. So write a scalar field is a function of time and space. I'll also denote this as 5x, where x here is a 4 vector. And so here A is a subscript that runs from 1 to n. We could consider n scalar fields instead of just a single one. And we can think of a scalar field as a generalization of a set of generalized coordinates in classical particle mechanics. So here QA is a finite number. And so the difference here is now we have a finite number of generalized coordinates for each point in space. So the analogy is that we can think of this as like QA and X of T. So for each of our scalar fields and for each point in space-time, we can think of having one generalized coordinate. And this analogy will really take us very far. So we all know how to quantize a classical mechanics problem. And the technique we'll take tomorrow when we quantize the scalar field is really going to be using this analogy, where we have think of the value of the field at each point in space as a generalized coordinate. So we can think of a field theory as an infinite number of degrees of freedom, where there's at least one per point in space. There's n if we have n scalar fields. Okay. So the case we're most interested in, if we are studying particle mechanics, is the case where the action can be written as an integral of the Lagrangian that depends only on the generalized coordinates and their first derivatives. So this is not the most general thing you can write down, but it's the most common case that you're used to in particle mechanics. So for a similar reason, we're going to restrict our attention to actions that can be written as an integral over time and space of a Lagrangian density. It's a function of the fields and their first derivatives. Okay? So a few comments about this form of the action. So notice we've written it as an integral of a Lagrangian density. So where these fields and the derivatives all depend on x, where x is a single space-time point. So if we write the Lagrangian in this form, where it's an integral of the Lagrangian density, we've imposed locality. So we automatically have a local theory if we write it this way. Secondly, I've written a partial derivative with respect to mu here. So we could imagine a theory that has different combinations of derivatives with respect to time and with respect to space. But such a theory would not necessarily be Lorentz invariant. So Lorentz invariance forces us to write something like this. Okay. Okay. So an example of yes.
Is guaranteed Lorentz invariance?
So actually, if it's just like this, this is not strong enough to enforce Lorentz invariance. We could imagine writing a term like this, if our Lagrangian contained a term that just had an uncontracted Lorentz index, that would not be Lorentz invariant, obviously. But if we we need each of the terms, if each of the terms in our Lagrangian density is individually Lorentz invariant, then our theory will be Lorentz invariant. So we need to write a term like this. Yes?
I didn't quite catch why integrating over space enforces locality, or what is that?
So so here, phi A depends only on a single point of x. We could imagine writing down an action. So if our action is, say, integral dt, integral d3x, integral d3y of L of phi A of x and phi A of y. This theory would not necessarily be local. So here we're restricting our attention to scalar fields. So under a Lorentz transformation, a scalar field transforms as follows. So it's just equal to phi of lambda inverse x, where we're considering active transformation. So we're not merely relabeling the coordinates, we're actually transforming things. So mostly writing this down to establish notation. So our notation here is that, so here lambda is a Lorentz transformation. Under the transformation where x goes to x prime mu, which is equal to lambda mu nu x nu. And lambda is a Lorentz transformation if it preserves the Minkowski metric. And I'll be using the mostly negative signature. So eta mu nu upper is equal to eta mu nu lower is plus 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. Okay. So here, this minus sign here comes from the fact that we're considering active transformations, as I believe you did in relativity. So that means under an active transformation, phi prime of x prime should be equal to phi of x. And if we so write this as phi prime, x prime is equal to lambda x. And then we can relabel x to get the form here. Okay, so the simplest example of a scalar field theory that we'll focus our attention on for most of today and tomorrow, for moving on to other examples, is the Klein-Gordon theory. And the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian is half partial mu phi, partial mu phi, minus half m squared phi squared. And so this is a theory of a single real scalar field. And we're using units here where h bar and c are both 1, as you saw in the front end course given by Matt. So this is our theory, and we'll spend some time today understanding the classical theory of the Klein-Gordon field, and tomorrow we'll quantize it. So the simplest question we can ask about this theory is, how does the field evolve? So to answer that question, we need to figure out the equations of motion. Okay. So in classical particle mechanics, we find the equations of motion by demanding that the variation of the action with respect to the generalized coordinates vanishes. And if the action takes this form, then the equations of motion are just the standard Euler-Lagrange equations. Yes, Dan?
Can you say something about the physical significance of what you're calling locality, say, in the last field theory case?
Sure. So if we have a action that looks like this, this means that all the interactions between the fields occur at a single point in space. Over here, we could have a term like phi of x, phi of y, where x and y are different. And so that, if we had such a term in our Lagrangian, in general, that would mean that the field at one point in space-time is affecting a different point in space-time. So that's non-local. Now,
is there anything exact you can say about, like, if you write down a Lagrangian that is local like that, then when you calculate the equations of motion every, I don't know what to say about that, but
yeah, so if we write down the equations of motion for a theory that has an action that takes this form, we'll just get a differential equation that where the properties of the field at one point determine the evolution of the field. That wouldn't necessarily be the case if we had an action of this form, unless there's something strange going on. The equations of motion wouldn't be just a simple differential equation in general if we started with an action like that. Yes.
So the quality you wrote for phi prime equals phi, that's because it's a scalar, right?
That's because it's a scalar, yes. So if we were considering a spinner or a vector, then it would transform in a different way. But, okay. So back to the equation of motion. So for classical particle mechanics, if you vary an action of this form over here, we just get the standard Euler-Lagrange equation, which you all know, just partial L, partial QA, minus d dt, partial L, partial Q dot A, equals 0. And we can do the same thing, basically, in field theory. So our equation of motion comes from demanding that the variation of the action with respect to each of our fields, if we have multiple, is 0. And a very analogous calculation that gives you the Euler-Lagrange equation will give you the equation of motion for the scalar field, which looks almost identical. Except instead of a derivative with respect to time, we have partial derivative with respect to partial mu. So this is our equation of motion for a scalar field, assuming the action doesn't have higher derivatives. Okay. So let's compute the equation of motion for the Klein-Gordon field. So if we look at this term, we only have one term that depends just on phi. So we get a minus m squared phi. And over here, we take the derivative with respect to partial mu phi. There's only one term that depends on partial mu phi. And so we get a partial mu. That's this partial mu acting on partial mu phi. And both terms are negative, so I'm just going to multiply the whole thing by minus 1. And this is our equation of motion for Klein-Gordon field. And we'll come back to this equation and solve it later in the lecture. OK. So another important result that's equally important for field theories as it is in classical particle mechanics is another theorem. So you've seen this twice already, but it's important enough that it's worth going through a third time for the case of fields. And so as you know, another theorem states that every continuous symmetry of the Lagrangian. Gives rise to a conserved current. J mu. And conserved means partial mu J mu equals 0. So this is a local statement. So the current, this is a current density, depends on x. And one consequence of Noether's theorem is if we have a conserved current, which we have if we have a continuous symmetry, we also have a conserved charge. And we can see that just by integrating the zeroth component of J mu. So if we define charge Q to be the integral over all of space of J0, then we can compute dQ dt. And this is just integral over all of space of dJ0 dt. Which, using the fact that J mu is conserved, gives us minus the integral over space of the divergence of J vector, spatial part of J mu. And we can relate this to a surface integral, Stokes' theorem. This gives us minus integral of J dot ds. Which is 0, assuming J goes to 0 sufficiently quickly. As x goes to infinity. It implies more than this, though. It implies that the charge is conserved locally. So if we define the charge contained in some volume V to be just the integral over the volume V of d3x, j0, then exactly the same argument says that dq v dt is equal to minus the integral of j dot ds on the boundary. So this says that the change in the charge enclosed in a volume V is equal to the net flux of charge that of the current that flows out of that volume. Yes? That Q is Lorentz invariant? So J here is a vector, so it transforms under Lorentz transformation. So J, the charge density is not going to be Lorentz invariant either.
But we didn't pick a coordinate system to show this, so the
factor Q is constant. Yeah, so
we must have picked four coordinates. Having time of J zero.
Yeah, we've picked a time if we right. Yeah, it's a good. Okay. Yeah. It's a good exercise. Okay. Okay, so let me just give a demonstration of why another theorem works. They'll allow us to construct what J is, depending on the particular symmetry we have. So let's suppose we have a continuous symmetry. And if we have a continuous symmetry, we can consider an infinitesimal transformation. So let's call our infinitesimal transformation Y. Okay. So this is a symmetry transformation if it changes the Lagrangian by a total derivative. And let's call the change in the Lagrangian the derivative of f mu, which can generally depend on the fields. So if it changes by a total derivative, then the equations of motion will be unchanged. Okay. So let's, to construct the conserved current, let's see how the Lagrangian changes under an arbitrary transformation. So, which I'll call delta phi A. So under and we'll impose that it's a symmetry transformation in a minute. Under an arbitrary variation, delta L, again assuming the first order form, is just the partial derivative of L with respect to phi A times the variation phi A, plus a term that's partial L partial mu phi A. Okay. And we can integrate this last term by parts. This is all under an integral. And we get the first term is unchanged. We'll get two terms when we integrate this by part. One will be partial mu, partial L, partial mu phi A, multiplied by delta phi A. And then we'll get a second term that's a total derivative. And it's just a derivative of the product, partial L, partial mu phi A with delta phi A. Okay. So this term here is 0. If the equations of motion are satisfied. So this is just our equation of motion here. So that means that if delta phi is a symmetry, that term vanishes. The equations of motion are satisfied. And we can write down an expression for the conserved current. Then we can equate our two expressions for delta L. So we have that partial mu f mu of phi is equal to this other term here. And delta phi A just becomes Y A phi. And so if we just move everything to one side of the equation, we get that partial mu J mu is 0, where J mu is partial L partial mu phi A times y a minus f mu of phi. Okay. So this is all general and somewhat abstract. So let's look at a few examples of important symmetries that come up all the time and figure out what the conserved currents are. So one example is translations. So let's suppose that our Lagrangian is translation invariant. So it has a symmetry, x nu goes to x nu minus epsilon nu, where epsilon is infinitesimal. So under this symmetry, phi a of x, epsilon is infinitesimal, just goes to phi a of x plus epsilon nu, partial nu, phi a of x, where we've just taken the leading term in the Taylor expansion of phi of x. So if epsilon is small, we can just approximate phi of x plus epsilon mu as phi of x plus epsilon nu, partial nu, phi a of x. And this plus sign here is because we're considering active transformations. So that is, so we've basically figured out what y is in this case. We also need to figure out what f is to compute the currents. We need to figure out how the Lagrangian changes when we do a translation. But the Lagrangian is also a scalar, so it transforms in exactly the same way. So L of x goes to L of x plus epsilon nu, partial nu, L of x. So we've determined what y is. So y a here is epsilon nu, partial nu, phi of x, and f mu is epsilon nu delta mu nu times L of x. Okay. So we can plug those in to our expression for the conserved currents. And since we have four different parameters that parameterize our translation, we can translate in any direction in space or time. So there's four independent space-time translations. So we have four conserved currents. So our conserved currents, j mu nu, are given by partial L, partial mu phi a, partial nu phi a minus delta mu nu L. And this is a quantity familiar to you from your relativity course, the stress energy, or energy momentum tensor. So the translations imply the conservation of the energy momentum tensor. So note that this is a density. if we want to calculate the total four momentum, we need to integrate. Over space. And it's just the integral of t 0 mu. And so tomorrow, when we promote everything to operators, this is the way that we'll figure out the momentum operator. So we can compute the energy momentum tensor. Then promote the fields to operators and figure out what the momentum operator is. Okay. Yes?
Should it be obvious how mu became a tensor in there? It seems like it's just a collection of vectors in mu.
So we started out, we can make this argument for any value of nu. We could think of it for 0, 1, 2, 3. And we get four independent conserved currents. So that's why I've written it. This way, we can, just from Noether's theorem, we get four independent conserved currents, but we notice that if we put them back together in this way, we get a tensor instead of just a vector. Okay. Yes?
So I guess that if we just redo the whole thing in another reference frame, then we would get the same expression.
That's right. Yes.
There from the line above, like the derivation of Gradian density.
Yes. This here is delta mu nu. Okay. Here? Yes, but we can write this term, write it over here, epsilon nu partial nu L as epsilon nu delta nu mu partial mu L. So that's all I've done. So I've just introduced an extra dummy index. Because eventually, so I've sort of hidden something. Here, so these are, so I've stripped out the infinitesimal parameter. So the form I wrote over here, these are infinitesimal, right? But if this is conserved for any value of the infinitesimal parameter, it's also conserved if we just strip out that infinitesimal parameter epsilon. So I've done that. Not so explicitly here. And in order to do that, I needed to introduce this dummy index. In my second example, I'll be a little more clear about that. Sorry for glossing over that point. Does that answer your question? OK. So second and final example of how to use Noether's theorem is a U1 internal symmetry. OK. So let's consider a complex field. Phi, which we can think of as being built out of two real fields, phi 1 and phi 2. But it's often useful to, instead of thinking of phi 1 and phi 2 as being the two independent real fields, to think of phi and its complex conjugate as independent fields. So we can write a Lagrangian that's constructed out of phi and phi star that has a U1 symmetry if we write something like this, where every phi is accompanied by a phi star. So we have a kinetic term, and then we can have a potential term, an interaction term that depends only on phi, the norm of phi squared. So for every phi, there's a phi star. And if we write a Lagrangian like this, it has a U1 symmetry or a phase symmetry. So under the transformation, phi goes to e to the I theta phi, and phi star goes to e to the minus I theta phi star, this Lagrangian is invariant. So here we're considering a global symmetry where theta is not a function of space-time. So this is a global symmetry. And Tipper will tell you about how to make this local, but we'll go into that. So that means we can just move the derivatives right through the e to the I thetas, and all of the theta dependence will cancel out. Okay.
Yes. A question about terminology. So U1 symmetry, does that say global or local?
No. So it's left unspecified. So we would use the same terminology when Tibber talks about QED the week after next. That will be a U1 local symmetry.
Right. And also, you said we're treating capital phi and phi star as independent variables.
Yes.
But this transformation sort of respects their relationship as being complex conjugates of one another, right?
That's right. Yeah.
We could also have done just an arbitrary scaling to A times the field and the other one 1 over A.
We could, yes.
Is that allowed, or does it have to?
So you're asking about, so we put a factor of A here and 1 over A here.
Yeah.
So that's, so if A is a constant, then the Lagrangian also respects that symmetry. But that's.
It's just that now the new phi and phi star are not.
That's right. So we could impose that symmetry, but that would then we could, yeah, as you said, we couldn't think of it as a complex scalar field anymore. Yeah, I see no reason why we couldn't. That would be just a different symmetry. So it's the same way in complex analysis. You can think about Z and Z star as independent, even though they're related. But you can, for instance, if you want to write down a analytic function, that means it should depend only on Z and not on Z star. even though if you know Z, you can determine Z star.
They're going to be independent insofar as we're, when we're working with the actual gap area,
then we'll vary them independently.
Yes. But any real field is actually going to have to happen.
Yeah, if it's a real field, then we would impose.
Any field satisfying the equation. That's going to have to happen.
That's right. So we have this symmetry. We could so given the symmetry, we need to find how the fields transform if theta is infinitesimal in order to find the conserved currents. That's very easy to do. We know the general form of the transformation. So if theta is infinitesimal, then the variation in phi, we can just expand e to the I theta to linear order in theta. And we get that this is just I theta times phi. And similarly, delta phi star is equal to minus I theta phi star. And our Lagrangian is invariant under this symmetry. So delta L is 0. So that means F is 0. And then we can write down the conserved currents. And so here we're treating phi and phi star independently. So the conserved currents, or theta times the conserved currents, are partial L, partial mu phi, delta phi, plus another term comes from the variation of phi star. And so if we vary L with respect to partial mu phi, what we get is just partial mu phi star. And so everything has a theta, so I'll just leave it out here. And this is just phi. Already pulled out the factor of I. Over here, we get the same thing with a minus I and phi star and phi switched. So this is our conserved current. And the interpretation of the charges associated with this current can either think of that as electric charge or net particle number, where we take the number of particles and subtract off the number of antiparticles. And we quantize this theory, as we'll do later in the week. Phi will correspond to the particle, and phi star will correspond to the antiparticle. We could. In general, we could. But if we plug in our transformations, each term in our Lagrangian is invariant under our symmetry transformation, unlike the case we looked at earlier, translations. So there, under our symmetry transformation, our Lagrangian was not invariant, but it transformed to a total derivative. So that meant that it was still a symmetry. That's right. Any other questions? Okay, so that's another theorem. So when we quantize, particle mechanics theory, we take the generalized coordinates and their associated canonical momenta, and we promote them to operators that have appropriate commutation relations. And we'll take that approach when we quantize the fields. So we need to develop the Hamiltonian formalism for classical fields. Unfortunately, it's very similar to the Hamiltonian formalism for particles. So just briefly remind you how this works. So the momentum conjugate to the field, our fields phi A, is just derivative of Lagrangian with respect to the time derivative of the field. So this is the momentum or momentum density conjugate to phi A. And this is exactly what you'd expect based on the analogy with particle mechanics. So if this was particle mechanics, we would write P A is equal to partial L partial QA dot. Exactly what you'd expect. And the Hamiltonian density then is, again, basically what you'd expect, just the product of pi A and phi dot A minus L. So this is really the big difference is these are densities. And if we want to compute the total Hamiltonian, we just need to integrate this. So let's compute the Hamiltonian for the Klein-Gordon field. So we'll need this and the momentum associated with the Klein-Gordon field. We'll need these quantities when we quantize the field. So Klein-Gordon Lagrangian is, if we write things in terms of separate out the time and space parts, 1/2 phi dot squared minus 1/2 grad phi squared minus 1/2 m squared phi squared. So there's only one term here that depends on phi dot. So if we want to compute pi, which is just partial L partial phi dot, it's very easy. Only one term here, just phi dot. And then we can plug that into the bottom formula and the middle formula on the board up there to get the Hamiltonian. So the first term, pi phi dot, is just equal to pi squared. And then we subtract off a 1/2 pi squared. So we're left with 1/2 pi squared. And then we just flip the sign on all of these other terms. As we're subtracting off the Lagrangian. Computations were not very difficult here, but just a few comments on what we're doing. So this is not manifestly Lorentz invariant. We've picked the time. So explicitly here, we separated out and treated time and space differently. So this is one of the disadvantages, I guess, of the canonical quantization method that we're going to use. You'll see in the next QFT course, in QFT2, it's possible to quantize the fields preserving Lorentz invariants if you use the path integral method. But this method is more direct. Lorentz invariants is not manifest, and it's not going to be manifest many points throughout the next few weeks. And we're going to have to explicitly check Lorentz invariants to make sure we haven't made any mistakes. So Lorentz invariants is not obvious in the method we're going to use. So it's going to be something we're going to be coming back to several times, checking to make sure everything is Lorentz invariant. Questions on this? Okay. So the last thing we're going to do today is we're going to actually solve the Klein-Gordon equation that I wrote down earlier. And put it in a form that is going to make the quantization that we'll do first thing tomorrow very easy. So I've done most of the hard work in the quantization today. And tomorrow we can start by quantizing it and see quantizing the Klein-Gordon field and seeing what the consequences of promoting the field and its momentum to operators are. Let's find the classical solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Okay, so if you remember from earlier in the lecture, our Klein-Gordon equation was partial squared phi plus m squared phi is equal to 0. Okay, so we can solve this most easily by taking a Fourier transform. And we're going to take a Fourier transform with respect to space only. It's not a very Lorentz invariant thing to do, but we'll look at the Lorentz invariants of our answer at the end. So we can write phi of t and x, d3k, over 2 pi cubed, e to the I k dot x, times I tilde of t and k. So we plug this in here. It's what we get. Is just a equation to phi double dot minus plus k squared phi plus m squared phi equals 0. And the solution, this is everything that's tilted here. And the solution to this equation is phi tilde t and k is equal to some unknown coefficient ak e to the minus I ek t plus b of k times e to the plus I ek t. So here a and b are unknown coefficients, and ek is just the square root of k squared plus m squared. So it's the energy of a single particle with mass m and momentum k. Okay. So this is the general solution. But if a and b are complex, then it's not guaranteed that phi will be real. So Klein, we're studying the theory of a real scalar field. So we need to check whether phi is equal to phi star. And that will put conditions on A and B. So if we demand that phi is equal to phi star, then we have that phi of t and x is equal to the integral d3k over 2 pi cubed e to the minus I k dot x times phi tilde star of t and k. So that's just taken this equation and get a minus sign from the I, and this is start. We can do a change of variables where k goes to minus k to fix the sign up here, to compare it to just phi. And if we do this change of variables, the measure doesn't change. So we're still left with d3k over 2 pi cubed e to the plus ik dot x phi tilde star of t and minus k. OK, so what we see by comparing this equation and this equation is that phi tilde star of t and minus k has to be equal to phi tilde of t and k. So this gives us a constraint on the coefficients a and b. And if we look at, plug this into our equation here, what we get is a star of minus k e to the plus I ek t plus b star of minus k e to the minus I ek t is equal to A of k e to the minus I e k t plus B of k e to the plus I e k t. And so this has to be true for all t. So that tells us that A star of minus k is equal to B of k. Our, and the other constraint is equivalent. So B star of minus k is equal to A of k. So. So let's plug that back into our equation for phi of t and x. And what we get here is e to the minus I e k t plus I k dot x and an A star term of minus k e to the I e k t plus I k dot x. This first term is, this first exponential, at least, is nice and Lorentz invariant already. So this is e to the minus I k dot x, where k0 is equal to ek. This other term, we have a plus sign in both terms in the exponential. So this is not Lorentz invariant, but we can change this whole term. We take k to minus k. The measure is invariant. Instead of A star of minus k, we'll get A of k. So this becomes A star of k e to the I e k t minus I k dot x, which is, this is just e to the plus I k dot x. So after this change of variables, this exponential also becomes nice and Lorentz invariant. We're still left with a measure, which is not Lorentz invariant. So when we quantize the field tomorrow, these A's are going to become our creation and annihilation operators. So it will be convenient if we want our states to be Lorentz invariant to make these A's and A stars Lorentz invariant. So we know phi is Lorentz invariant. This is Lorentz invariant. So if we make this Lorentz invariant, then these should be also Lorentz invariant. So let's see if we can massage this integral integration measure to make something Lorentz invariant. So the natural starting point is integral d4x. Say over 2 pi to the fourth. So that's clearly Lorentz invariant. Now, here we're integrating only over spatial, over the spatial part of K. So if we put a delta function here and use it to integrate over K0, then we can relate this Lorentz invariant measure to the three-dimensional spatial measure we have up there. So in particular, since we want K0 to be equal to EK, this should be delta of K squared minus M squared. So if we write this out, this is delta of K0 squared minus K squared minus M squared. So at least the solution where K is positive constrains K0 to be EK, which we want it to be. So this is Lorentz invariant. But we only want the solution with positive K0. So let's put in a theta function. Constrains K0 to be positive. Now it's no longer invariant under the full Lorentz group. But if we just consider the proper orthochronous Lorentz group, those transformations that are continuously connected to the identity, where we're not allowing parity transformations, k goes to minus k, or time reversal transformations, t goes to minus t, then this expression I've written here is invariant under those proper orthochronous Lorentz transformations. And so what we wanted to relate this to the integral d3k over 2 pi cubed that we had before. To do that, we need to do the integral over k0. And using what you learned in the front end about delta integrals, we can do that. And we get just a factor of 1 over 2 ek. So this here is Lorentz invariant. So if we want things to be Lorentz invariant, we should pull out a factor of 1 over 2 EK from our A's. And let's define A of K to be small a of K over 2 EK. And if we do that, then we can write solution to Klein-Gordon equation as an integral d3k over 2 pi cubed 2 ek a of k e to the minus I k dot x plus a star of k e to the I k dot x. And so tomorrow, when we quantize the field by promoting phi and its canonical momentum, pi, to operators, these A's and A stars will also be promoted to operators, and they'll correspond to creation annihilation operators that create and annihilate particles with definite momentum. So we'll see how that works tomorrow. But we've done most of the hard work in quantizing the field, and so we'll actually do the quantization tomorrow. Any questions? Yes?
I've given no information for the tutorials.
Okay, tutorials are at 9 o'clock on, for the first 2 weeks, at least, from 9 to 10:30, Wednesday through Friday. The third week will be a little bit different. But, and they're in the Sci room, which is just next door. Yes. So this scalar field is Lorentz invariant. This measure is Lorentz invariant. These exponentials are Lorentz invariant. So these have to be Lorentz invariant. Yeah. Any other questions? All right, I'll see you tomorrow.